are struggling to get through. I don't know, my department. I don't know if Clinton is.
I reported this as a spectacular visual.
No. Must be careful.
No, I reached out for protection.
How was I get there?
Who wants to join? Who wants to join?
You must be knowing the voices by now, Che. Again.
Kuban.
Mamela.
Oh,
disappeared.
You feel like that?
Yes.
Honorable Gwenya, lawyer, where is the voice here?
Hi, Bo!
How?
Some people were not yet born.
Wawuthi xa uye eJoburg once in 6 months ibe yinto enkulu ozayibalisa unyaka wonke ungene eJoburg.
Sorry to interrupt, chairperson. The time
are you ready? 12 o'clock.
Yes, we can proceed. It's 12 o'clock now.
I guess. Baba mute ke ngobonke abantu.
I guess.
All right. Inantsika ke flight ayi agenda mntasekhaya.
Before umkele ne confirmation of members, okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay, qala ngayi. All right, qala nge confirmation of members, that's fine.
Okay. The minister and the deputy minister, officials and the stakeholders that are in this meeting. My role is just to confirm members of the portfolio committee that are in this meeting. Chairperson, I have the following members. I have you, Member Kungubele, I have Member Ngwenya, I have Member Masango, I have Member Pilankulu, I have Member Aries, I have Member Abrahams, I have Member Fandameve. Those are the members I can see in the participants list thus far. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Are you suggesting that? Can you repeat the list quickly?
We are a quorum, Chairperson. We can.
Can you repeat the names, please, if you don't mind? Can you repeat the names quickly? There's something.
Okay. It's you, Member Ngwenya, Member Masango, Member Pilankulu, Member Aries. Member Abrahams. Member Fandameve. That's the members thus far.
Yo.
I'm so,
open.
Okay. And Member Mvana, sorry ma'am, the list is long. I didn't pick up that as the other around. And Member Stock, Ghana.
Member Stock.
Member Stock. Sorry, members. Any member that is available to confirm?
Hi. Thank you for correcting that. Otherwise, members of monitoring a lot if the meeting.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Good morning, honorable. Good day, honorable members. Can I take this opportunity to welcome the minister, the deputy minister, and the team? We were with you yesterday. We are continuing. It was joined, and then it's a standalone National Assembly Portfolio Committee meeting. And we'll be meeting today to look at a matter, very, very touchy matter, which COVID is not allowing us to get close to it as a portfolio committee where we do oversight. Because if there's a one area where we must do oversight, honorable members, is the GBV mat. It's one area where before this term ends, we must look back and feel proud of ourselves. It's one area where I think if we really are South Africans who take themselves serious, that is, this is the area where we should actually 24 hours be focused, and then make sure that this relationship between men and women is corrected, is improved, because for this country to prosper, this relationship must change. And oversight is going to be very, very fundamental on it. But COVID, now we're at level 2, honorable members. I can't wait for level 1. I can't wait for level 0. So that we can be able to do our work in a more proper way. We want to go to the shelters. We want to go to these various other institutions that are dealing with psychosocial, post-trauma, counseling areas and whatever. Whatever name you give to them, especially, I think it's pillar number 4, am I right? Yes, yeah. That is one area where we need to spend a lot of time on, but having been clear with the issues in pillar 1, pillar 2, and pillar 3, and so on. And I'm just calling upon all members that we should actually work hand in hand. To me, this issue of GPV is not an ideological matter. It's a partisan, it's a non-partisan matter where all political parties are supposed to hold one another hand in hand and correct it. There's nothing ideological about oppressing women. It's just madness. So it needs all of us to work for. To me, issues of gender, issues of corruption, and all those are not ideological issues. We're supposed to be holding one another and fight those things together. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, honorable member, and I must again take this opportunity to welcome the minister and head team and look at check if there are any apologies in it.
Chairperson, we've only received one apology from a member, Sukars, who's not well. So she went with us today due to ill health.
We're going to miss her. Okay. Well, that's the only apology you have?
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Can you table the agenda?
Okay.
Can you scroll it, take it up?
Sorry, Chair.
Yeah. Where is it going now?
Sorry, Chair.
There is it, honorable members. It's two items. It's GPV presentation and presentation by Dr. Harris on and how to deal with the issues on Kombat. Those are the two items we have. Can I table the agenda, honorable members, for your adoption?
Honorable
Mvana, I propose adoption. Oh, there's COVID update, sorry. Yeah. Any seconder?
I will second the adoption, honorable chairperson.
Please, thank you very much, honorable Mvana.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Good day, Honorable Fanda Mbeki. I didn't see you.
Hello, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Those are the items, Honorable Members. Honorable Minister, we are in your hands.
A very good morning to you, Honorable Chairperson, and a very good morning to all the Honorable Members, and I think my Deputy Minister is also in the meeting. You see, it has become a bit difficult for us because we don't see each other now. We rely on this on this platform. But having said that, I think we are getting used to the platform. Chairperson, safe to say that there are still some protocols we need to adhere to and get used to. Otherwise, we'll start talking other things on this platform. Somebody knows what I'm talking about from earlier on.
okay.
Yes, Chairperson, it is an honor for us to be back again after a short recess. A recess, obviously, that was very difficult because we were unable to do what we normally do when Parliament goes into recess. We also go to the centres and places which are supported by the Department of Social Development and its portfolio. But there are a few places that we managed to go to. The DM also managed to go to some places. It's very difficult because we have to expose ourselves, but there's work that needs to be done, and so we will continue doing the work. I also want to thank you, Chairperson, for raising the issue of gender-based violence and femicide, and also to indicate that this is a non-partisan matter. For real, this is a non-partisan matter. This is a matter that we all have to hold hands together, because gender-based violence doesn't actually ask which party you belong to or which class you belong to or where do you live and how do you live. It doesn't ask. It's a societal problem. We have to keep on going back to the fact that it's a societal problem that we all have to help each other. This is a matter which, in my view, we have to step up as communities in terms of behavioral change. Because we might be looking at people who are abusing women and children and isolate them from the greater challenge of society. It's a societal problem. It's an old age problem that many of us, one way or the other, and I can tell you in the room where we are right now, many of the women who are here will tell horrendous stories. And the painful part about it is that many of us who are women supposedly in certain positions are not supposed to expose ourselves to the challenges that we have, even in our own families. Yet at the same time, we are supposed to be exemplary because we are the people that need to make the policy decisions. We are the people that have to put the programs in place. I always say in the olden days when we used to talk about gender-based violence and how some of our own women would not want to talk about their own situation, I used to say we wear the two aprons, one for going out at work and one that we have to wear when we are at home. And if we can break that down, it can make a big difference, because it's no point with us sitting here and talking about these issues when we are struggling with those issues in our own homes and we are too scared to even talk about it because we don't want to be hanged out there. It is said we are hanging our dirty linen. So to the men and women who are present here today, in my view is that the Chairperson is spot on about this being a non-partisan issue. This is an issue that we should not turn into a political football. It is something that we all have to work together. And my view, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that we must go back to some of the old age things that we used to do of knowing home to home, street to street, community to community, just the neighbor knowing without necessarily interfering, but knowing that something is happening next door that shouldn't be happening. So I am of the view that we need to go back and mobilize a chairperson, you would know better, and all those who are in the room who know what it was during the liberation struggle when we used to have very strong community committees that used to guide us and help us into who is where and why and what is happening. Even this issue of gender-based violence, if we are to be honest ourselves, it's not something that our communities would have been proud of. We're never proud of it. You would hear here and there maybe some men when they are drunk, they would walk around and say, me, I'm going to slap my wife. That's the way I show how much I love my wife. And the wife would also go out and say, oh, yes, my boyfriend or wife or boyfriend, my boyfriend gave me a clap. He's doing that because he's showing love. This is the time we've developed programs that help us with behavioral change of our communities. It doesn't matter how long we've been in democracy for me. What matters is this is the situation we're in today. This is what is happening. And as I started the meeting, I was called, I was being called by the MEC of KZN. And let me tell you, when I see that call of the MEC of KZN, my body just freezes. My intestines just knot because I'm fearing what is the MEC going to be telling me now after all the bodies that were discovered, what is she going to be saying? So I will call her after this because they're just those provinces where you know when the MEC calls you, you have to answer quick because chances are that she's raising issues of gender-based violence. She's raising those issues. So I think that what we are doing here today is something that I personally, as well as the portfolio, I know the other sisters who work with me, they take this very seriously. We have to do everything we can. And one of the things that I think is a weakness in our system is the proper coordination between ourselves and social development, women, police, justice system. We still need to find a way of really like working together, not because some event or some incident has happened. We work together because we are saying 365 days of the year, we have to do everything we can to make sure that the work that we do must be seen, must be felt by the communities on the ground. And I think that we also need to call upon the different NGOs and NPOs that are doing this to also have a very coordinated approach towards it so that we don't occupy this platform because we are trying to show that this one doesn't do the work and that one does the work. We occupy the platform because we want to make the difference that Chairperson, you always talk about us seeing the impact of the work that we are doing. So today, we have to ensure that those who have experienced abuse are able to access appropriate support also. And the appropriate support we are talking about is not only the support that is rendered by the Department of Social Development. It is the support that is rendered also by many other departments. So this is the essence, for instance, of the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide, which was developed by the Interim Steering Committee following the historic 2018 Presidential Summit. The NSP provides a multi-sectoral and coordinated national response, which was approved by Cabinet in March this year. It is a call to action for us all over the next, it's not 5 years anymore. It's now about 4 years or so. A call for us in the next years remaining to work together so we achieve our shared vision of a South Africa free from gender-based violence and femicide. The department will make the presentation, Chairperson. Safe to say that I do want to say that the NSP is anchored on six pillars, namely accountability, coordination and leadership, prevention and rebuilding of social cohesion, justice, safety and protection, response, care, support and healing, economic empowerment and research and information management. And so I'm not going to go through the entire plan, the entire presentation on my side because I think that let us allow the department to make the presentation so that we enable also the time for questions and so forth. Safe to say, Chairperson, that I do want to say that Pillar 4, we have recently gazetted the Victim Support Service Bill for public comment. And I'm saying to the department, let's not sit and say we have given it to the, it's going to go to Parliament. Let us make it our responsibility also to mobilize people to make the necessary input so that everyone who needs to make the input is aware of that. And I call on both members of the Portfolio and Select Committee to popularize the bill in your constituencies to ensure that our legislation keep pace and that our interventions are responsive to the life experience of gender-based violence. So, and then lastly, we also have the CARA funds, which I'm sure, Chairperson, part of what you were speaking about, that you are unable to go to the centers. This is one area with regarding to funding. We have allocated 100 million from the Criminal Assets Recovery CARA funds account to provide financial support to organizations rendering services to victims of crime, gender-based violence, and femicide. And the department will provide more information to members about this. And your task, obviously, is that of ensuring that the oversight is done, the right organizations are being given the money, they are also accountable for what they do. We also see the impact of the work that they do. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll give over to the department.
Department, how many minutes are you going to take? Because in Parliament at 2 o'clock. Department. ADG.
Yeah, they had a bit of a problem with connection. I hope they've connected now, Che.
Okay.
Yeah,
hello. Okay. Yes. You are speaking from far, Linton.
Okay. Sorry, Che.
Sorry, can you hear me now, Chair?
Yes.
Okay, no, thank you very much, Chair. And we are advised that we are not the host and therefore we can't share the presentation, Chairperson. The host first needs to disable the screen so that we are able to share the presentation.
Can the host disable the screen for them?
No. Okay. Chairperson, I've made LinkedIn and Olile Broker the co-host, so he will be able to make the presentation at any time.
Okay. Are you able to see it now?
Just right. Not yet. It seems to be coming.
Okay.
Not yet. I don't see it yet. Was that too late?
Nancy Jefferson.
I was like, one hour done. Guy born him. Yeah, one hour done. Just see one as well.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
How many minutes? Okay. 10 minutes? Or 15? 20?
Or 15 is fine, Chair.
15 or 20? 20.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Push.
Okay, no, thank you very much, Chair. Okay, let me just start now.
Your presentation has disappeared. Yeah, where's the car? Kaibo.
Chair.
Yes.
I can maybe rescue the situation for the sake of progress and flight from my side.
No, if it's assisting, please do it quickly. We need to move now.
Can you see it, the presentation?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Clinton. Clinton. DJ.
Bridget.
DJ.
Chair, I'm not sure if you can hear me now.
I can see the presentation. They are flighting it from the Parliament side.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chair. We are really struggling with the connection here.
No, it's fine. They are
I think we are load shedding.
Lindy, can you open it? It's small. Can you try to...
I'm trying to set slideshow.
Try to expand it a bit.
Okay. I'm trying to put a slideshow. It doesn't want to do it. Can you see now?
It's getting worse now.
Yeah?
Yes, we see it, but it's small.
It's very small.
Oh, there we go. So if you can press... I'm not sure why it's not working.
Start load show. I'm starting to start.
Just go to the from beginning, then we'll be good.
Must I stop? And you'll fly from your side? LinkedIn?
I'm still struggling. Yeah, if you can just press from beginning, then we should be fine. Sorry about this, Chair.
Okay. That's it.
Okay, thank you very much, honorable members and Chair, and apologies once again for the challenges with the technical areas on our side. We are load shedding, and so we're using, I think it's a generator that's on. Chair, we would just by way of course, we are presenting to you our comprehensive plan to address gender-based violence and femicide as per the request of the Portfolio Committee. If you go to the next slide, please. Let me just deal with the situation analysis. As you know, the country is experiencing a very high level of gender-based violence, and despite the state chat interventions, both civil society as well as private sector, we have good policies in place, good programs in place, but the challenge is that elements of gender-based violence still persist and still continue. And so we think that this is a behavioral change challenge, which is also associated with cultural norms and, of course, the prevalent patriarchal system. And our view is that the NSP will assist us in better coordinating this work, because as it is, a number of departments are doing a number of things around gender-based violence, and the NSP really puts this together and so that we're able to respond accordingly in this regard. Of course, our niche area or area of focus as the Department of Social Development, you'll see there is psychosocial support services within our shelters, of course, and of course providing trauma counseling. And you'd note that the recent crime stats recorded around 42,228 rape cases. These are only cases that have been recorded. Other cases have not necessarily been recorded. And so our view is that this will probably increase close to the hundreds of thousands, if not even more, if those cases that were not that were reported were also included in this. So I think it's also important to highlight that there are challenges around the manner in which the cases are classified. So if a person is committing what we would ordinarily call a gender-based violence case, when the person is found guilty, they're not classified and criminalized for gender-based violence. It's either rape or it's either called assault. So we're talking to justice to see how best we can deal with those challenges so that we're able to manage that. Of course, the minister also spoke about the victim support services bill and the work that we're doing in that regard. And in essence, we are saying that in general, the criminal justice system has basically paid a lot of attention on the perpetrator's rights as opposed to the victim. And the victims are often neglected. So the public are being asked to make input into this bill. And really what we're trying to do is also to ensure that the bill focuses more on, or rather the work of the criminal justice system focuses more
or centralizes victims in that regard. Maybe it's also important to say that there's some literature out now that is beginning to validate the work that we are doing as a department. Recently, of course, Lisa Fitton, who most colleagues would know, has written around the importance of helplines and sheltering. And some of the research that she says there is basically indicating that victims of gender-based violence are not keen to open cases. Rather, they seek health services and trauma counseling services. So we have call centers, of course, that are dealing with some of these areas. You can go to the next slide. In terms of the helpline, they're saying that because they're provided, these provide immediate access to emotional support enable the victims to remain anonymous. So let me just also indicate that she indicates that the sheltering breaks the cycle of violence by providing a range of services such as temporary safe accommodation, basic necessities, trauma counseling, and limited skills development in some areas. It's important to note, Chair, that the Commission for Gender Equality also acknowledged the importance of sheltering services. And in their recent study...
You must correct that word, the importance. You see, it's wrong. While Commission on Gender Equality acknowledged the importance,
Yes. Apologies, Chair. It's important. You're right.
Yes, proceed. Okay.
Chair. And of course, the study also reflects a number of challenges. Some of these challenges, let me just speak to one or two of them. In the shelters, one of the issues is that we tend to focus more on individuals rather than families. So if a mother would come with her kids to the shelter, in all likelihood, they would take just the mother and not necessarily the mother and the kids. Of course, some of the shelters are also not LGBTQI plus friendly. The acronym is not easy to get. And of course, the other issues which the shelters have raised in a number of correspondence even to us is the fact that the funding is not standardized, and that it continues to be a challenge. And of course, what we're doing is we're trying to enhance our coordination with SAPS, health, and other relevant departments so that we're able to provide necessary services. Can we go to the next slide, please? I'll ask Cesar to talk to one or two of the areas around the NSP and our work, particularly as it links to pillar four and one or two of the other pillars as well. Can we go to the next slide, please?
Is that the slide you want, Cesar?
No, the one before that, Chair.
Okay, go back with this.
Chair, Honourable Members, Minister and Deputy Minister, my name is Cesar Mahangwe. This one on the journey, just to briefly share with the committee the journey that we took when we're developing the NSP. It's important to note that
the NSP?
The National Strategic Plan of Action on Gender-Based Violence. And
that is very important. Yes. Somebody who is a member of the NSP is not a member of the NSP. All right. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. We looked at a number of documents that have helped us to inform the development of the NSP, which is the program of action that we had as a department before. We also looked at the 24 demands that were crafted by Total Shutdown Movement. We looked at the Presidential Summit feedback. We looked at the declaration itself. We also looked at the consultation process. There were 9 provincial consultations that took place. There are the dates that we conducted. There was also online Facebook feedback that we are receiving, as well as specific sector consultations. Like, there were a number of sectors that were consulted, unusual stakeholders, like the business sector was consulted, the youth sector, the labor sector, as well as the community-based sectors. So out of all those consultations, a draft was developed and approved. It was presented to cabinet, and it was approved. Next slide.
In terms of the next slide, these are just the pictures, Chair, of the consultation process and the groups that we had. And those groupings, mainly the things that they raised, they were critical issues. Like, for instance, they raised the issue of effective criminal justice system. They raised the issue of safe transport, street lights, drug trafficking, policing. They raised the issue of rapid teams that need to be established at a local level. They raised the issue of addressing women's economic vulnerability, issues of parenting, as well as alcohol abuse interventions. Those were the issues that were critical that they expected the NSP to address. Next slide. The next slide is basically about the purpose, to say what is the purpose which the minister has already alluded to, and it's also capturing the vision, to say the vision that we really want to arrive at is that all people in South Africa must feel safe, particularly women and children. And we also hoping that this plan will enable women to realize their rights as people of South Africa. Next slide. The next slide is about the pillars. The minister has alluded to the pillars, but I just want to indicate who is leading, because all these pillars have got different departments that are leading. The first pillar one is led by Department of Women, Youth and People with Disabilities. Pillar two is led by the Department of Higher Education and GCIS. Pillar three is led by the Department of Justice. Pillar four is led by us, DSD. Pillar five is led by Small Business and BTI. The last pillar is led by CERT-SA and DPME. Thank you. Next slide. I'll skip the slide because we've already talked to it. The next slide. The next slide is about prevention, which is critical. As much as it's led by Department of Higher Education, as a department, we also contribute for the number of advocacy campaigns that we are doing. We have a Men and Positive Role Model program, as well as Men Championing Change. The reason why we're working with the men's sector is because we believe that they will break the cycle of violence. We also have a number of activities that we are planning, the 100 days activities that will contribute to 365 days. And we also have Human Trafficking Week line up coming in October as part of 100 days. We are also focusing on what is happening in institutions of higher learning. We've got programs that address GBV and substance abuse. Currently, because of the situation that we are in of COVID-19, we are exploring using campus radio stations, their websites, online student chat platforms. We also focusing on family strengthening as a prevention program. We do have family strengthening program as well as a family preservation program. YOLO and ZAZI are some of the programs as well as Kimoja that we are using for social behavior change as well as prevention programs that assist us to address the scourge of gender-based violence and substance abuse. The next slide is the list of all those programs. I won't go through it, but just to indicate that we've got partners, implementing partners that are assisting us in those communities. And we also have we're reflecting all the nine provinces. And we also have the districts where we are implementing these programs. Of course, not all districts are covered, but majority of the districts are there. The plan is that for the areas or the districts that do not have these programs, we are going to coming up with a plan to abstain and make sure that they are covered in all the districts. The next pillar is pillar three. It's on justice. I think the minister spoke about it, but just to highlight here that as much as we are not responsible for the domestic violence as well as the criminal law on sexual offences related matters, but we did make substantial contributions when they were reviewing it because it's affecting our victims. And what was also important here is that the sector was saying the current challenge with all the laws that we are having or the legislations that we are having is that if a woman's body happens to be the crime scene, then the onus is on the woman to prove that indeed crime happened, unlike when a crime scene is outside your body. So they were saying whatever the legislation that we are coming up with or we are reviewing, we must ensure that we address that issue so that justice system can be victim-friendly rather than what is happening currently. The next slide is our pillar four. It's also important to indicate, Chair, that what we are trying to achieve with this pillar is that we are trying to create safety net for women. We also want to also increase access to psychosocial services, because psychosocial services are not available in all the areas. So those are our areas of focus. We want to focus on that and make sure that that's what we are achieving, or that's what we are going to achieve. And just to elaborate further in terms of what is this pillar stand for. The first part, it talks about strengthening the existing responses. The NSP does acknowledge that services are there, but what is not there is a comprehensive service. At the end of the day, we'll make sure that we meet all the needs of the victim, and the victim is healed at the end of the day. So it does acknowledge that we've got the shelters, we've got the tutorial centers, we've got the victim-friendly facilities and police station. But what we need to do is to strengthen those services and make sure that at the end of the day, they put the victim at the center. The second issue about this pillar is the issue of secondary victimization. To say, there's a challenge in the sector that a lot of victims are afraid to come forth and access the services because of they get victimized for the second time. So they call it secondary victimization. So this pillar is there to fight the issue of secondary victimization, to make sure that at the end of the day, we eliminate it completely. The third one, Chair, is looking at making sure that the victim feels supported and the victim is able to access the issue of psychosocial services, so that at the end of the day, they can experience healing and total recovery. The last one talks to building relationships. It says strengthen the community-based relationships, because these issues are happening at a local level, at a ward base. So whatever mechanisms or measures we're coming up with, we must make sure that really we build the capacity at a local level. And furthermore, it also says, as we are addressing the gender-based violence, we also need to look at how substance abuse and HIV are drivers of gender-based violence. Our program must also address these challenges. Next slide. The next slide, a chair, just to summarize because of the time. What is important here is the issue of the psychosocial services. Like we said, that we want to make sure that it is everywhere. So we are focusing on it, and we are also strengthening the services that we are currently providing. We are using the command center is one of the vehicles that we are using to provide the psychosocial services, as the acting DG has alluded to say. It's one of the areas in the literature is saying we need to invest more on this, because a victim find it easy to use, it's convenient, it's anonymous, it has many reasons why people want to use the helpline. The other thing, Chair, we are also looking at dedicated social workers who specialize in trauma. We have invested on that and will continue to invest on that to train more social workers at a local level that are going to provide trauma counseling. We have deployed some of the next to Zellers centers. We have deployed them in victim-friendly police stations. We have also deployed them in our PSD facilities. Of course, not all the police stations have those social workers, but what we did, we looked and we have prioritized the areas that have high prevalence of gender-based violence with a plan of phasing in more and more social workers. Next slide. The next slide is about, we just demonstrate the command center, the figures that, the calls that we dealt with before lockdown and during lockdown up to now. So far we have received 13,571 calls, as well as the please call me 2.8, and as well as SMSs. And during lockdown from the 27th up to today, and we have received 83,787. So, and the number goes on. So, of course, there's a significant increase on the number of calls that we have received. And the calls, not all the calls, share, they are for GBV. Of course, I would say maybe 50% of the calls, they were related to GBV cases, whereas the other 50% is for other issues, like it was for information. People were phoning, requesting information around social relief of distress, how to go about and looking for information. So there was that balance, but we did witness high levels of calls during that time. People were traumatized and they needed someone to talk to. Next slide. The next issue that we are also focusing on this pillar is the issue of capacity building. The training of the social workers to deal with the issue of trauma is quite critical, especially the frontline workers. The issue of family strengthening, we already spoke about. We said we've got a parenting program. We call it Spin of Wheel. It's one of the programs that we're implementing in all our, in seven provinces, except Housing and Western Cape, but there are plans to make sure that they also have that plan. We also have family preservation programs, reunification services to address all the challenges that families they are contending with. The next slide. The next slide is the slide on strengthening the civil society, because as the minister has alluded to, this fight, we cannot fight it alone. We really need the CFOs to be on board and we support them. So there was an allocation of 100 million that was granted by cabinet from the recovery assets account. And the purpose was to strengthen the NGOs. That's exactly what we did. We did it with the support of the NGA. 95 million was allocated to all the NGOs, and 5 million was earmarked for mentoring and coaching, because we realized that emerging organizations are struggling with, they are struggling to access services and also to comply. So therefore, we said in order not to set them for failure, let's also have mentoring and coaching as a program that would support them. So in total, 100,000, that's what that's the allocation we received. The applications, we had about 312 applications from the NGO sector, and 131 CFOs have been paid their first tranche, and they are waiting for the second tranche. Next page. This is just a list of all the capacity building programs that we have exposed our frontline workers. All in all, 525 frontline workers were trained on GBV related matters. Next slide. The next slide, Chair, is a Women's Month activities that we have. This activity, we keep on updating it. There are many more activities that the minister and the deputy minister will be leading throughout. We've already started and will continue until the end of the first. In the interest of time, I'll skip all these activities. But suffice to say, we are currently rolling them out as we speak. The next slide is on pillar 5. Next, we skip that one as well. Pillar 5, next one, yes. Pillar 5, as much as it's not led by us as a department, but we do contribute in terms of our shelters. We are revamping our shelters, Chair. We are establishing a very strong development aspect so that women, when they leave our shelters, they are able to be employable. So that's what we are doing currently. We're working with the Department of Labor as well as Public Works. Pillar 6 is about research and information. We are working with DPME on this, looking at the research that we are currently doing so that they can inform our intervention. Next slide. The next slide, Chair, is about the challenges that we are faced as a sector, not only as CSG. The first one is limited capacity of the staff within government departments as well as local government. That makes it difficult to address the issue of gender-based violence adequately. Secondly, the issue of inadequate funding keeps on tripping up. It's a challenge that we are currently facing. Surgery has tried to increase our budget, but there's still not enough to address the issue of gender-based violence. Now there's a call that the private sector must begin to come to the party to contribute as well. There's also an issue of lack of accredited skills development programs in the shelters. Myself, we've got shelters that are running. The challenge is to have the skills, the hardcore skills that are accredited by the CITAS. We are also working with CITAS to try and put in place the skills development program. The other issue is the psychosocial support services to make sure that they are accessible everywhere. The issue of multiple structures, communities are complaining that you've got too many structures that are happening that are all addressing and running. So the NSP will help us to address that. Next slide. The last two slides here is about game changers. To say what is it that we think we can do in the short term to try and address some of the challenges that have been alluded to. First one is strengthening the referral path so that we don't lose, the victims that don't fall through the cracks as they move from one SLS provider to the other. The second issue is the issue of localizing the structures. That we've got a lot of structures at a provincial level and national, but the problems are at local and there's nothing at local. So there is an issue of rapid response teams that must be established as soon as possible so that they can link women to all the services that they're talking about. The third one is the upgrade of infrastructure so that at the end of the day, we have a shelter that are accommodating the LGBTI communities as well as family units. Another issue is the issue of information, the database. Currently, we have databases that are not linked to each other, and yet we are servicing one victim. So we are working very hard with justice, SRAPS, and NPA to link our system because we are servicing one victim. The other issue is the issue of government and civil society frontline staff. They need to be debriefed because of their handling traumatic cases and to also prevent the burnout. So it's quite critical that the debriefing program is there to assist them. The other issue is the capacity building that we need to continue to invest more on training our frontline workers so that they can prevent the secondary victimization that we alluded to. The next slide, Chair, it talks about the change that we require at all levels. Basically, it says for us to really make the difference, a fundamental change, all these errors must be covered by this NSP. It talks about at an individual level, what is it that must happen? At a family level, because this incident is happening at a private space level, what is it that families need to do in order for them to really receive benefits from the NSP? It also talks about relationships that between men and their partners, relationships, how to build those relationships and make sure that they don't have toxic relationships. It talks about children that we need to make sure that this plan also invests on children so that they're not victimized further. It also looks at society and community level to say, if we are saying that the NSP is working, all these levels must attest to that and say, indeed, these are the changes that we have witnessed. The last slide check talks to recommendation. We are saying it is recommended that the portfolio committee take note of the GSD plan in implementing the NSP on GBV and femicide 2020 to 2030, as well as the progress here that we have achieved and the challenges that we are needed to as a sector. And also we are saying the cultural committee notes that the minister is with the support of the deputy minister, they are ambassadors of Pillar 4, and also to note that the FS provincial level, the MECs of social development, they are expected to be the ambassadors of Pillar 4. I have been featured.
Yeah, honorable members, DJ, do you want to say anything before we go for discussions?
No, thank you very much, Chair. I think we can go straight to discussions. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Honourable, I would like to say something, Chair, if you would allow me.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. There's just the two, three things that I feel were left out in the presentation that I'd like members to just note. The first one is we did launch the 0800-150-150 line in partnership with South African breweries to actually ensure that services are accessed by men, because we can't just say we're reaching out to men in terms of them having dialogue, but it's a WhatsApp line that men are able to reach out for assistance without necessarily, you know, feeling embarrassed and all of that. And from the time that we launched it on Father's Day, which was the 21st of June, we 59,000 men have reached out and are into our support programs that are linked to Takuani Rime, Men and Boys Championing Change, who are going through, you know, violence and who are victims of GBV as well as perpetrators. So I thought I needed to just alert the committee to that. It's 0800-150-150. And then I wanted to add the issue around sheltering as well, just to add to what Cesar has said. And then the committee should note we have three different types of shelters, so that there's that understanding we've got. The highest secured shelters, I think we have 13 of those. And then we've got your your long-term stay shelters. And then we've got your wide door centers of hope that are community-based. The security levels differ based on the kind of the crime committed. So that the pink drive outreaches 10%, because I just wanted to add that to indicate that these outreaches that I referred to that we were leading are also to bring to effect the contribution of cancer to gender-based violence, especially the four cancers, which is prostate and testicular, cervical and breast cancer. Because they are linked to the bedroom chair, you know, the jewels of the family, they are the big contributors to gender-based violence. So in these outreaches, it's an integrated government outreach, but we also do GSD part of our prevention to make sure that men and women are actually tested and they get free services, so that we make sure that they are able to get assistance. The last one is the sign language interpretation services that I think it's very important that the committee
is aware
that.
You said the three things, DM. I think you are getting stamina now.
That's the last one.
Okay.
That is important. Before you ask us that, the command center is disability friendly, even deaf. Disabled women are actually accessing, even when they are deaf, they are accessing the command center services. We do have deaf employed social workers in that one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jim. Honorable members, I've got the following names in my chat. Honorable Ngwenya, Honorable Abrams, Honorable Fandemeve, Honorable Aris, Honorable Manganye, Honorable Masango, Honorable Bilankulu, Honorable Mvana, Honorable Anastasia Mtaung. I'm going to stick to a 4 minutes principle. It's even a lot, because I'm looking at the time at our disposal. Can we start with Honorable Ngwenya?
Engos Kakulche, I will stick to the 4 minutes. Whatever is left, I will do it in writing. Firstly, thank you very much for the presentation. Mine is mainly on pillar four, which I feel that the DSD must make sure it is very important that they excel in this pillar and go above and beyond and make sure that they bring change in the GBV and F situation in this country. Firstly, I would like to ask, I've seen in the presentation, if we can get, I know that ADG touched on it slightly, but if we can get all the information on the CGE report, the report that they, the study that they conducted on the challenges that are faced by the shelters that they need to be looked into. Secondly, I need to emphasize mostly on the GBV Command Center. I do commend them that they're looking into, they are disability friendly, which is very good. And I just want to stress and emphasize on the fact that it must not be just on receiving calls and collecting steps. We must be seen, the GBVCC must be seen to be very reactive and very responsive to the calls of these women, that we are able to come and say, the GBVCC, these are the calls we got, this was the response that we did, these are our referrals, and these are the follow-ups we made in terms of the GBV, so that we know that the GBVCC is making changes within the issue of the of gender-based violence and femicide. I cannot stress enough, I've always stressed this in the meeting, Chairperson, we need centralized database. It is very important that in this country, we learn the skill of centralizing data, because that will assist us so much in dealing with so much things, DSD, health, police, education. If we can have a system that collects all the data and it is centralized for every department to be able to access that. Also, I would like to request the MECs of every provinces, if it is possible, Minister, that as it is said on the report, on the presentation, that they are ambassadors of the GBF programs within their provinces. Therefore, it would be nice to have them now and again to come and tell us what is happening in their provinces, the strides that they are taking, and their proactive programs that they are doing within that. We note the challenges noted in the presentation of the NSP, and I think that we need to dwell on that so much and see what can be done at a later stage. So I will send those in writing to make sure that I give my 2 cents contribution on those, on how we can assist. And on pillar 4 as well, on pillar 3, I just need to find out. I heard that DSD made a contribution on the VSS bill. I would just like to find out that what was the contribution of the DSD on that bill. And I also want to know the contribution made by DSD on the amendments of Domestic Violence Act and Criminal Law on Sexual Offences Related Matters Act. And the timelines, if possible, on the policy on sheltering services and the policy of provision of psychosocial services. How are they going to do it? When do they think that we will have that policy in place and implemented? There is a lot, Chair, but I will stop there and I will send others in writing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bunganya. Honourable Abrams.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the Department for the presentation. Chairperson, my questions or statements goes around what the Minister said earlier, and in that we'd like to see the impact of the work that we're doing on the ground. And in this portfolio committee, we speak a lot about asking how is the programs and interventions impacting and whether we can measure this. And I'm happy that the Deputy Minister gave us something in that 59,000 men are currently, who have accessed the WhatsApp line, are currently now in the DSD programs. So my question then is to go a step further and ask the department, can we not then get the information and the data on of the women who access the command council? How many of those women are then successfully removed from their violent situations? How many of those women are successfully placed in our DSD VEP programs? How many of those women that come through the command council get placed in our shelters? You know, and once again, how many of the men are in the programs and in the family strengthening programs? Because it's very good and well to have these presentations where we discuss the policy framework, and we discuss what services they are, but we need to start looking at the second part, which we never quite get, and that is the actual data on the impact that these programs are having. Because when we look at our annual crime stats, it almost feels that these programs aren't having any impact because the numbers keep getting higher. And if the numbers are keep getting higher, then there's something amiss that we're not doing right. And then also, Chairperson, then maybe the question should be, is can the department provide the committee with a more comprehensive report on the data and the challenges and the successes? And not just, because also before, they would give us the total of the GBV calls, of the total calls coming through to the command center, but then they would also break it down and give us the numbers of what is not related to GBV and what is related to GBV. And then to go a step further, because since we are talking about the impact of alcohol on GBV, can we not get the stats and break it up a bit further in that what were the calls between the ban on the alcohol under the certain levels and when the ban was lifted, and then again when the ban was reintroduced, and now once again the ban is lifted? Because it's only through the actual evidence and the data can we see real impact. So I just would like to know if we can get that information. And another stat that would be useful is how many of these women are repeat callers. You know, what is the stat on repeat callers of women calling into the command council? And then lastly, Chairperson, under Pillar 4, the slides speak about women accommodation beyond the shelter, and I just want to find out if beyond the shelter means a halfway houses, and if that's included in any way in the new Victim Support Services Act. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Abrahams. Honourable Fandamava.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and yes, thank you very much to the department, the Minister, the Deputy Minister, for the presentation. And I would like to agree with the Honourable Minister that this can definitely never be a political issue and that we must all unite to fight gender-based violence. I would like to start with the issue that I've raised before, Chairperson, and that is that there seems to be a problem, and I would like to get some thoughts on this from the Minister and the Deputy Minister about what is going on in the Eastern Cape. You would have seen, we spoke about Lisa Vetten in the introduction, but there seems to be quite a serious problem with regards to payments, with regards to the Eastern Cape and payments to their non-profit organizations, which affects not only, for example, women's shelters, but also old age homes. So I also know that there's been short payments to various organizations in other provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the Northwest. But have you been able to establish what the problem is? Because the fact of the matter is we cannot have plans and programs, again, that aims to fight and deal with gender-based violence, but then when we need to refer women that are in desperate need for help to shelters, they find themselves on the doorstep of a shelter that's not received the funding that they need to be able to assist women and children in need. So I need to get an indication in that regard. The ADG did speak about shelters, the importance of shelters, and he did mention that shelters have been complaining about funding is not streamlined, or for example, in some instances, a shelter might be getting a stipend from government that's 10 rand, while another shelter might be getting a 50 rand. How long will it take for you to be able to streamline the stipends? So the policy timeframes, which the Honourable Ngwenya also spoke about. I would like to also emphasize on what the Honourable Ngwenya and Abrams have said in terms of the call centre. I think we've made this plea on numerous occasions that when we speak, for example, about that 102,000 calls, SMSs, interactions that we've received to the call centre over this lockdown period, at least there we need to see a breakdown in terms of calls received, how many of these were serious enough cases that they were, you know, X amount of these calls were referred to shelters, X amount of these calls referred to somebody being treated in hospital, X amount were referred to the police for investigation, and X amount is, for example, in front of the court currently. Because I think when we look at a number like that without having proper details and proper information in terms of the logical follow through, you know, whether any of these people have really gotten the assistance, the help that they needed, that information will remain not too useful for us. Again, I would like to ask the CARA funding. I'm a bit confused because in our last meeting, I remember when President Ramaphosa announced this funding, I thought he promised 200 million. I was later corrected to say that he promised 50 million, but today the minister is speaking about 100 million that has been allocated to the NGOs. I need to also ask whether all of the NGOs have received their stipends and whether we can be given a list of NGOs that will be benefiting from this CARA funding. And just to link again to the issue of proper data, we spoke about having proper information in terms of the logical follow-through. But for example, in these pillars, we speak to the issue of not only sheltering women, but then giving them access to job opportunities and skills training. And I think as we progress in terms of this national strategic plan, at a later stage when we come back, when you come back as a department, you also need to report to us, for example, this woman was removed, went to a shelter, was taught a skill, and has been successfully rehabilitated maybe in another community, or she's received
your time is up, Honorable Panamera.
Okay. All right. Thank you. But if we can see that type of information going forward, thank you.
Honorable Aris, thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable Aris.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson. Morning, Minister.
Good morning, Honorable Aris. Yes, good day.
Chairperson, victims of gender-based GBV experience high levels of post-traumatic stress. And I have noted in the presentation that they say they have a helpline that offers services. But what about those people that don't have access to technology, and is that the only services that we render to these people? And then, Chair, the shortage of shelters in this country is huge, but apart from that, there's a need for multi-sectoral post-GBV facilities, shelters, to work with survivors and victims, because when people get out of these shelters, there's no post-GBV facilities for these people. And then in Pillar 4, Chairperson, with women, the program for August month, I have noted, is mostly digital. My question is, what about the people in the deep rural areas that don't have access to these technology TVs, DSTV, and all these things? What about that? What programs do we have for those, or how will we reach that people? Then I've also seen, I didn't hear that you said the Department of Public Works, because this GBV is not only a DSD program, but it is a multi-departmental program. Because apart from that, the Department of Public Works has the facilities, as you said, to the shortage of shelters. They have the facilities where we can, work with them to get access to their buildings to bring up more shelters, because that's a big problem in the country. Then in terms of the educational plans, I did hear they say the Department of Higher Education are also on board, but yes, we need the Department of Basic Education also, because educational programs, we need to get this in schools, and it must start from a primary level, that where we start to educate our learners on the importance of GBV and self-respect and respect to others. And then, Chairperson, we must not only talk about GBV, we must give it a name, we must come up with a slogan for this. I have read an article in Palestine They have this thing, they call it my body is my property, where all women are wearing bracelets that said my body is my property, to create that awareness, you know, that women need to wear these bracelets. And then in terms of programs, we need to come up with programs like Honorable Lethal Fanameva was saying. We need to come up with programs where we must empower this woman, that the woman stop being dependent on their partners, because then that's where they become the victims of these gender-based violence. And then also, Chair, in terms of, I didn't hear that you say that we also have the Department of Labor, apart from physical abuse.
For the first time, Honorable Alice, for the first time, you speak beyond your time. It's unusual.
Sorry, just this last one. In terms of the workplace, because women are also suffering mental abuse from the co-workers, the employees, and that's also things that I would see that we address. Thank you. Sorry about that, Chair.
Honorable Manganya.
Thank you very much, Chair. I must also thank the department for this presentation. I just want to ask or make a comment. I was happy when I hear Linton and Kholile mention the shelters. My recommendation is that about the shelters is that maybe sometimes when NPO or NGO applies, before it can be given a go ahead, the national that receive the application must also include the local authorities, that they should look at that particular building. Sometimes we give them the go ahead. Little did we know that they don't even have the shelter. The shelter, if they have, is also danger to itself or to the beneficiary. So my recommendation is that while we want this NGO and NPO to be around, let's assist them, because some of them really, they are struggling about the structure. Noting that the department is currently busy developing a policy on provision of psychosocial service, how does this policy permanent employee, unemployed social welfare, who are needed so badly around our community? How are they is going to support? My second question, Chairperson, I'm sorry for that. My second question, what measures are in place to ensure that the challenge reflected in the Commission of Gender Equality report on the state of shelters are urgently and adequately address? How do the contribution made in CGE report contribute to the national strategy plan? Chairperson, as we are not only complaining, but trying to come up with some of the issue, I think the department have this strategy, I think it's come with good plans and good intention. But I'm just saying up front that if, Honorable Ngwenya have said, if MECs can be part and parcel, because some of the issue really, it needs them, that they should tell us if these things, they are supporting all these people who are doing their level best to support our people or to assist our people. Maybe in future, because we don't have land as the social development, whereby we are using the SAPS building, maybe we should have this portable because some of the building really is not user friendly. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Manganye. Honorable Masango.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just sorry that I can't show my video because my connection is quite weak.
We know your picture, don't worry.
No problem. Thanks, Chair. I just want to agree with, in fact, thank the department for the presentation and also agree with both you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Minister, about the fact that the fight and response against GBV is non-partisan, it's multi-sectoral, and it's something that we all have to fight against all together. I just am very excited to see the pillars that have been presented here this morning, today, and just hope that the pillars don't become silos in practice, that all the leading departments of the various pillars work in silos, and in the process, the women are falling between the pillars, and they don't get the service that is being done by the NSP, I believe. And also, Chair, I see that. I wanted to find out if the people, the NGOs, as we all work together on this, the NGOs and the organizations, government commissions such as the Commission for Gender Equality and the organizations like POA and all those that work in this sector, if there will be a time at any stage where we will get to hear as the Portfolio Committee what it is that the strides that they are making in the work that they are doing in fighting gender-based violence and femicide. As far as the database is concerned, I just want to also add my voice into this because it is proving to be such a challenge. And I seem to have heard the Honourable Minister some time ago saying that there was a partnership that was entered into that was going to, the partner with whom the department was working was going to help with this database situation. And I just would like to know how far that process is in terms of actually making sure now that we don't keep saying we are working on getting the database sorted out, but where we are saying there is a database that is in place, as it were. As far as the work that is being done, the very amazing work that is being done by the command center. In just also confirming is that one would like to know that there is some aftercare mechanism of sorts, that these women are not just phoning on the day and are referred, but that there is some kind of knowing whether they are out of that situation or they are working to get out of the situation in the process. And also, Chair, I'm just asking you if it's possible, especially now that we are having this document that was presented today, to actually have a standing item or on GBVF like we are having with COVID, if that is possible at all. It's just my request for that. I thank you, Chairperson, for your time.
Thank you, Honorable Masango, Honorable Icon. What has gone wrong now? It was Honorable Masang, am I right? Now, Honorable Mtau.
Yes.
Honorable Mtau.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
You must see a doctor, man.
I have seen it yesterday.
Okay. All right, proceed.
What were the contributions? This one, I think, Member Ngwenya touched on it. What were the contributions made by the department made to the Domestic Violence Act and criminal law on sexual offense related matters?
Do you have to do this? I don't think you should do this to yourself.
Not right.
I think you must attend to your...
Maybe the member can write the question.
You can write down and we'll deal with it. Okay, Honorable Mdaung?
Okay.
Please, don't do this to yourself. You must actually look after your health. We need you here.
Okay.
Honorable Pustok?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also join my colleagues in welcoming the presentation of the department. Let me also join my colleagues in welcoming that good presentation. We also need to appreciate the kind of work that has been done by both the Department of Social Development as well as the Department of Correctional Services. We have also noted that there's a lot of legislative work done by the two departments. For an example, when it comes to Department of Correctional Services, the Cyber Crimes Bill, and then also on the social development side, is the amendment of the Children's Bill, which has been conducted to deal with GBV in the country. But my only concern, Honorable Chair, is that this work that has been done by this department has not been consolidated into one approach. So from my side, I would like to find out what has been the progress in consolidating this legislative work into one approach so that we can have a single picture of the state of GBV in the country. I would also like to find out when can the joint committees expect a report in this approach, if that is going to be possible to consolidate the work of the two departments into one. How will also the work of the two departments contribute to the implementation of the national strategic plan on GBV, as it has been highlighted in terms of the six pillars? And then lastly, I would also like to find out, as the department forced a partnership with the Department of Public Works in December 2019 as part of the emergency response plan on GBV. This is important in finding spaces for Kuseleka, One Stops, and the wide door safety spaces for hope in six identified provinces. So it's also important that the department takes us into confidence about the progress in terms of this partnership. And then also, as the process of formalizing the memorandum of understanding been finalized, and then what is the contents of that memorandum of understanding, if it is there. And then also in relation to the six provinces that have been identified, when will the remainder of the three provinces receive spaces for their own Kuseleka centers in the wide door safe spaces? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Stock. Can I come to the department? You've got strictly 15 minutes, otherwise time is bad. Maybe, let's say up to quarter.
How did I miss you?
You were, Honorable Bilambulu.
Yes.
You appeared here. I don't know who removed you.
Tell that person to bring me back.
Okay, speak now. But you are not here, Honorable Vana.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and good morning to the Minister, Deputy Minister, and everybody else in this meeting. In acknowledging the research that has been conducted on the impact of the GBV helpline, which depicts a picture of GBV victims who aren't willing to open cases and who experience a high level of post-traumatic stress, how does the National Strategic Plan on GBV advocate for the addressing of these challenges? Secondly, Chair, what has the research study gathered from the GBV helpline revealed in terms of the state of GBV in the country. And again, how has this research contributed to the intervention provided by the department in addressing GBV? How has it contributed to the input made by the department in the National Strategic Plan on GBVF? Lastly, Chairperson, I just want to check from the department if sometimes one way or the other, if they do get the report from the justice system on how all the GBV cases are being handled across the country. Thank you very much, Chair.
Oh, thank you very much. Honorable Mvana?
Thanks, Chair. Mine are similar to the ones of Honorable Vilankulu, but I'm interested to get the information in terms of out of the revised budget adjustment vote. Has the department ensured that its targets are in line with National Strategic Plan? The last one, I think she has asked about the challenges that the department is encountering out of the budget that we have. Then I would like to get the solution of those challenges that they are experiencing or encountering. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mvana. I know the minister expressed a genuine worry about the time we give to responses. I'll take a risk and say, can you take up until 10 to, Minister? Minister? Are we still together? Hey, Lindy, what happened?
Don't know, because the minister is saw her picture, and LinkedIn, I can see LinkedIn.
DG?
I'm also here, the minister.
Can you guys respond up until 10 to?
Yeah, I am here, Chairperson. I think it's just a... Can I ask the department to respond, because there's very little time. We'll just come at the end of their response.
Okay.
I think Lincoln didn't unmute. We cannot hear him. Unmute through you, Chair.
Yes. Linton, where are you?
I can see him. He's talking, but we can't hear him.
Linton! Can somebody pinch him or phone him, do whatever?
No, Chairperson, I can see him. He's on the screen. But I'm not sure what's happening to him.
Is he aware that we can't hear him? Because now I can't even see him.
I can see him. I can see him. I can see his gesturing and moving and talking.
Oh,
but we can't hear him.
You are using a different device. That's why you're saying. But the point I'm making is that I can't hear him at least.
Maybe let's ask the IT to do something.
Can the team take over those?
Can you hear me now, sir?
Yeah. Hey, who can hear you? What was going on?
Hey. Okay, thank you very much, Chair. I will ask Caesar just to respond very quickly to one or two of the elements, and then I will ask the CEO of NDA to also just speak to the CARA issue. And then I will add one or two inputs very quickly. We'll make it in time.
Okay. Susan?
Okay. Thank you, Chen. I'll respond on the issue of funding of CSOs, inconsistency of funding of the CSOs. That has been a challenge for some time, but now it's going to be resolved because we're asking for the funding policy framework to be approved first. That will allow us to do the standardization. It has been done. It has been approved. It's a question of now seeking more funding to make sure that we also have adequate funding to fund. Because we're no longer going to fund the we are going to fund the programs rather than an item or the way we used to fund. So that issue is going to be resolved. The issue on the staff, yes, of course, it is a challenge, the staff at the stage that we've got data, we don't have an electronic database system. We that was the problem. But now the problem is resolved because we've got an IJS program, intersectoral justice system program that we are benefiting from. They are assisting us to put the systems in place. We have to agree as all the sectors to say what are the indicators that we are all going to be reporting on and to also give each other access in terms of their system for us to access such system, such access our system. That process is done. It's we are about to roll out the system. We are waiting for the gadgets to be distributed in provinces. But the system, as I speak, is readily available. We just have to migrate from the paper base to an electronic system. There were questions around the policy. Yes, we have developed the policy. We are developing the policy on psychosocial services. The intention of the policy is to address the provision of psychosocial services, not to deal with the social workers as the people that are doing that. But the policy is there to, you know, regulate the space, because currently we don't have a policy that regulates the space of how do you provide psychosocial services. And we've got a lot of players within the space, and because the space is not regulated, it becomes messy. For instance, we've got abafundisi who are providing trauma counseling. We've got healers who are providing trauma counseling. We've got volunteers who are providing trauma counseling. We've got professionals, social workers, psychologists who are providing trauma counseling. But there is no framework that guides how this activity must be done. So we needed the policy to deal with that space so that we know who are the players, who does what, and who gives over to whom. So that's the intention of the policy. The other issue is there was a question around the intersectoral shelter policy to the timeline. It is a target that is on our APP. We are chasing that target. We are going to achieve it in this financial year. Mm-hmm. And we are on track with it. The question on the command center, I think for command center, we appreciate the input, we'll add those elements, because the command center, the way it was conceptualized, it was just a phone-in service where we refer. We'll provide a counseling service immediately. Thereafter, if a person needs follow-up or more sessions, we then refer to a service that is available at a local level. But I hear what members are saying. We will see how we build the system to make sure that we do, you know, follow-up. We can actually track a victim and say what transpired after everything has accessed services from us. Yeah, that's the last one is on the Kuselekas.
It must be the last one, Ziza.
Yes. The Kuselekas, the question was around what about the three Kuselekas? Why are they not here? Because we only refer to six. The three, they already have the Kuselekas. We've got Kuselekas in the Mpopo, Northwest and Eastern Cape. The six provinces that do not have Kuselekas, those are the ones that we are currently targeting, and we are working with Public Works to ensure that they do have their own Kuselekas at the end of the year. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe just three things, Chair, from my side. One, there's been a lot of comments this morning or this afternoon around data from the gender-based command center. Let me just indicate that we've now moved to a new premises, which is much bigger, and we'll be able to accommodate a little bit more of our staff. What we want to do is we want to have a command center in the true sense of a command center with big screens that you're able to tell what's happening across the country in real-time data. Providing real-time data rather. So we have expanded that, and we hope that we'll be able to invite this committee to come and view the center very soon. As Rebel Abrams' question around the impact of some of the work that we're doing and determining the challenges and successes, we want to look at implementing an evaluation or an implementation and evaluation study
to see what are the lessons we can learn and what impact we're having on the ground. That will also assist us in informing future policy making. But maybe also to respond to the issue of Member Adris, yes, indeed, there is a shortage of shelters. It continues to be a challenge. We've highlighted on slide number 10 some of the districts, which include some of the rural areas that we are that we have shelters in. And maybe in terms of Honorable Panamera's question around the Eastern Cape, so we're meeting the provinces tomorrow to further get a sense of what are some of the challenges around the payments of NPOs. I know that some of the challenges in some provinces has largely been attributed to the impact of COVID. So some of the colleagues were not able to go to the census to go and verify indeed that this is taking place and so on and so forth. So that has caused a bit of a stir because they were not able to move. There was a strike also. We advised the Eastern Cape around this. And some of the staff, I'm also told, that normally process this work have succumbed to COVID-19. But these are areas that we are taking up with the provinces to see how best we can assist in terms of improving or speeding up the payment, rather. Thank you, Chair. I'm done.
Is the department done?
I would then ask the Minister and the Deputy Minister, but maybe the CEO, the Deputy Minister first, then the Minister. But I think the CEO may want to talk to the CADA funding. Just the amount to confirm the exact amount. That's it.
You've got many CEOs. Which CEO?
CEO of NDA, sorry.
Okay.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Minister.
Good afternoon, CEO of NDA.
I need to respond to Honorable Abrams in terms of the figure. Yeah, indeed, it's 100,000. And the breakdown of the 100 million, pardon me, 100 million breakdown is 45 million as per MOU that was signed with the department. 45 million was the first tranche for us to get started, as you might know that we started in January. And the second tranche will be as when we produce a report from the first tranche. The 5 million will be for administration work that has been implemented by NBA since the start of the program. And as we see today, 131 NPOs or civil society organizations have benefited in terms of transfer to the value of 17.4 million. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Minister. Yourself and whoever else, you've got 10 minutes to close, or 5. Okay, 10, right? Minister?
Chairperson, I'm not sure if the DM wants to say anything.
DM?
Okay, sorry, sir, yes. Thank you, Minister. Just two things. The question around the legislation in terms of the Domestic Violence Act and the criminal. I will send the detailed input of the department as we made them at the JCPS. But just to indicate, it was more improving, Chairperson, things like your protection orders and how justice is supposed to deal with that. The issues around the consolidation in terms of child marriages and the issue around statutory rape, the issues around sheltering becoming a core and the rating thereof. But we made it at the last time, we will make the detailed document so that when these pieces of legislation come to Parliament, then the members can actually get. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you. Minister, you don't have to take the entire time. You don't have to take the entire time.
I won't, but you are taking away my time. Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick one. I think I want to take it from where the DM left to say that part of what I think needs to happen is for the members to be aware of how we work at an executive level through the other coordination, through other clusters like the JCPS and other IMCs and so forth. It might be a good idea for us to make that presentation in writing so that people are aware of what else do we do that supports this. I've always said to the department that the work that's done by the minister and the deputy minister sometimes gets lost because the focus is always about the programs of the department, and yet both the DM and the minister sit in other structures of government to make sure that this happens. The second one is for me to say that I think I've said to the department many a times that part of what becomes a problem, even when the members have to do their oversight, in many instances, the members don't see anything that is related to the work that they are doing, even in their own constituencies. So it's important for us as a department to have that interest. Where are the constituencies of these members? What is happening there? Do we have the same programs that we are talking about? Because now we are really wanting to focus on the district development model. And so that might even help us. I'm not saying that we'll only go to the constituencies of the members, but I'm talking even beyond the members of the committee itself. All the members who are in parliament have got constituencies, and the best way is for them to see some of the services that we are talking about. Then they can be able to do an oversight even in their own constituencies. Otherwise, Chairperson, I think the questions have been answered. And this work continues. I'm fine with it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Minister. I think my last words, which don't need the immediate response, is that the area of challenges that is articulated is an area that maybe next time we should have a sense what's going to be done about them. Your skill shortage is in an area where your psychosocial trauma counseling and so on. And all those challenges, coordination, access to this, to those services and funding and so on. Because if that is not addressed, it means they are there just as a formality. But thank you, Minister, at this point in time. Now we need to move to the next item. Minister, your team need to stay on this one. Dr. Harris?
It's Dr. Harrison. Yeah.
How much time do you need, Dr. Harrison?
I do need 20 minutes. I think this is a critical component. 20 minutes.
Because under any circumstances, we must close at... no, it's fine. It's okay. Go for it. Until 2:05, am I right?
Yes, that's correct, Chairperson.
Proceed. Are you related to Carla Harrison? Or is it Carla Harris? Not Carla Harrison. Okay, fine.
I'm related to Karen Harrison. Chairperson, let me start and firstly, good afternoon to...
You will start by introducing yourself.
Yes, exactly. So good afternoon, Chairperson and Portfolio Committee members, honourable members, as well as the honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, and officials. I'm David Harrison. I'm the CEO of the DG Murray Trust, which is a South African foundation committed to developing South Africa's potential. Just for some context, we work with the Department of Social Development quite a lot in terms of early childhood development and nutrition. We support initiatives such as Elifa Labantwana, Smart Start, Grow Great. So that's really our engagement. Today, I really want to be focusing on what we can do over the next 6 months to make a significant impact in terms of gender-based violence and some of its associated harms. And in this regard, I'm joined, just to say, I just want to acknowledge Dr. Charles Parry and Richard Mitsopoulos from the Medical Research Council, as well as Tenazo Nkwelo, my colleague at DGMT, who may, as specialists, come in and answer any of the questions afterwards. But if I may just proceed.
Yes, please.
So this really arose out of a letter that we wrote and I signed on behalf of 164 signatories, academics, researchers, civil society, some government officials, as well as some signatory organizations, really in response to the gender-based violence crisis, and saying that if we really are going to make a significant impact, we have to address the issue of alcohol and especially the excessive use of alcohol. That's probably one of the most significant impacts that we can make over a relatively short period of time. And as you'll see, we identified five specific interventions that have been shown to work the world over that are implementable at low cost that should be implemented in South Africa as a matter of urgency. And just in framing this, we have to acknowledge that the alcohol industry plays a positive role in our economy. The figures I use are fairly dated now, but I use them because the South African Treasury has done a review. So these are their own figures, as well as comparative figures of harm that we have from studies done by Dr. Perry and Dr. Mastopoulos. So let's acknowledge right away that alcohol has an economic benefit. But it's absolutely crucial, and this is what we're talking about today, that we understand that this is a calculus, that there are benefits, that there are very significant costs that have to be addressed. And we're talking here today about gender-based violence, and let's just be specific there. The studies that have done show that alcohol is a factor in at least 40% of rapes in terms of the reports of perpetrators who've been caught. About 40% of them say that alcohol played a factor. When we have a look at femicide, women who have died and at post-mortem, alcohol in the blood was a factor in 61% of cases. So a very, very fundamental exacerbator or aggravator of gender-based violence. Gender-based violence is about men, how they act, what they think, what they do. It's about power, but it is severely aggravated by alcohol. And if we're going to prevent and start to reduce the rate of violence, reduce the incidence of violence against women, we have to get to grips with this. Obviously, this is not only about gender-based violence. Alcohol is a major cause of excess mortality in South Africa. 60,000 deaths a year. That's about 1.5 times that of COVID. Obviously, we know the relationship between traffic accidents and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder as well. So as the committee tries to develop an approach to handle this, it's really important that we don't sort of get stuck in a very sort of polarized relationship between those arguing for the benefits and those arguing for the costs. We've got to understand and weigh up the benefits and the costs. And studies that have looked at the economic benefit versus the cost show that if you just look at tax revenue, as versus the direct cost to the fiscus of alcohol harm, you could say that in fact the net benefit is a positive one. If you start to look at the other spin-offs, the employment, tourism, and other spin-offs, and you add up on the other side the cost of loss of earnings, you could say, okay, we're more or less still heading in the right direction. Benefits outweigh costs. But the moment you start to look a little bit broader, when you look at the productivity losses to the society from absenteeism, when you look at if you assign any sort of value to life and to health in the country, we have a situation in South Africa where the costs associated with alcohol harm significantly outweigh the benefits. And one of the reasons why this is such a massive imbalance is that we have a massive culture of heavy drinking in South Africa, and that's what we have to confront. I talked only about economic benefits, but what about the social benefits and costs of the alcohol industry? And this I think is where this committee's commitment and the fact that gender-based violence has now become a national priority really emphasizes the fact to us that government is saying that no longer can personal enjoyment of individuals, can socialization and camaraderie that is put up as a positive benefit of alcohol, no longer can that be unlimited and at the expense of women and children who are being abused. So I alluded to the culture of heavy drinking in South Africa. Let me just show you what I mean. If you look at the middle column, which is the per capita consumption per drinker of pure alcohol in South Africa. And you see that the average drinker in South Africa drinks 5 units a day or twice as much alcohol, pure alcohol, as the world average, and about 1.5 times the rest of Africa. We have a problem that is as bad as Russia, as bad as Belarus. And sadly, if you have a look at the age breakdown, the percentage of those who drink, who say they've drunk more than 5 drinks in the last month, look how severely biased it is towards younger people. 80-85% of our young boys and men saying that they're already becoming acculturated, they're already heavy drinkers. And so we really need to get to grips with the problem of binge drinking, of heavy drinking in South Africa, and understand why. And I don't have to tell you how deeply steeped this is in the history of South Africa. The DOP system that is responsible for so-called cultures of heavy drinking among sectors of our population. But also, let's not forget the history of beer in South Africa, the dispossession of from black women of the sorghum beer industry right back in 1928, the institution of these municipal beer halls, then the use and the direction of profits from these beer halls towards the Bantu administration boards to ostensibly upgrade townships, but increasingly to fund the Bantu stans. These are the roots of the culture of heavy drinking in South Africa. And it comes through in terms of the socioeconomic gradients that we're seeking to address. If you have a look here, you can see that a far higher percentage of black and colored men reporting higher incidences of binge drinking. Similarly, if you look at men who are employed for cash piece jobs versus those who are employed but not for cash, a much higher percentage. And so this is a vicious cycle of social and economic marginalization that we need to break. Marginalization leads to heavy drinking. Heavy drinking leads to marginalization. And this is fundamentally a social development issue. The burden of alcohol-related mortality as a consequence falls most heavily on the poorer people. The yellow are injuries, the blue are drink-related incidents. And you can see that deaths in lower and middle socioeconomic, much higher proportion, much higher number and proportion among poorer people. And so the bottom line is that the following national priorities are unattainable unless we curb heavy drinking, and we have to confront this. We will not achieve major reductions in mortality that results in 200,000 excess deaths in South Africa if we compare black mortality versus white, if we don't address the 50 or 60,000 deaths from alcohol. We won't address gender-based violence, and we won't achieve the type of progressive social development we're talking about. And so we're really saying that the president has said we need to look at drastic actions to curb the abuse of alcohol. We're saying, no, you actually don't have to be drastic. We need to implement policies that have been shown to be highly cost-effective, feasible, implementable at low cost, that will create a virtuous cycle that will have compounding benefits. And these are they. Firstly, the comprehensive ban on alcohol advertising, not on alcohol, on alcohol advertising. Increases in the price of alcohol, reduction in the legal drinking limits, reduce the availability of alcohol, and increase access to counseling and testing. In the last 10 minutes, I just quickly want to go through the case for each of these and why they're so important to view them as a basket that needs to come together. The case for a comprehensive ban on alcohol advertising, and here we're saying a ban on advertising of alcohol except at the point of sale, where it shouldn't be visible to those under 18. International studies showing that if you do that, if there's a comprehensive ban, you can get a 1.2 reduction in prevalence. Now, the point I want to make through all of these graphs is that if you look at these numbers on their own, 1.2% reduction, you might say, well, that's not that significant. But when you look at them together, when you put them all together, and when you look at their compounding effect over time, they start to have a significant positive effect. It's like the governor of the Reserve Bank saying we're going to reduce the interest rate by 0.5%. It has a knock-on effect when we consider all the other aspects. And so here we see that learning from the international experience, learning from tobacco advertising, you can't do this piecemeal. If you want to be effective in terms of advertising, you need to put a comprehensive advertising ban in place. Piecemeal, limits on TV, limits on billboard is simply not going to do it. In South Africa, we know that advertising harms adolescents. For each advertising medium exposure that adolescents in South Africa have, they're 13% more likely to drink. So that means if they're exposed to seven media platforms, different media platforms, they're twice as more likely to start drinking early. And as you can see, they not only start drinking early, but they start drinking a lot. We've got a lot to learn from the success of the tobacco advertising ban in South Africa, where between 1993 and 2010, we saw a decrease from a third of our people drinking to a fifth of people drinking. And that happened in South Africa while the rest of Africa was going in the different direction. In terms of raising the price of alcohol, I don't really have time to go through this graph, but really just saying that there are two strategies that we need to look at. The excise price of alcohol in South Africa is in real terms now lower, much lower than it was in the 60s and 70s. The excise price of tobacco has gone up, but excise prices for alcohol have not gone up to the same extent. So we have to push up those excise prices. We also have to look at other measures, something called minimum unit pricing, where we create a minimum unit below which a unit of alcohol cannot be sold. Because as we'll see in South Africa, there's price differentiation so that the poorer communities are actually sold alcohol at a cheaper price. That's not on. When we look at the price elasticity of demand, in other words, if you increase the price of alcohol by 10%, how much, what percentage reduction do you see in alcohol consumption? Overall, we see about a minus 0.5 price elasticity of demand. In other words, lifting the price by 10% reduces alcohol consumption by 5%. So we have to find a way of using pricing as a way of reducing alcohol consumption. And as we know, that it will have the biggest effect on heavy drinkers. So the second is to raise the price of alcohol. In South Africa, heavy drinkers in South Africa, as I say, are paying five times less per standard drink than moderate drinkers. And introducing a minimum unit price will have the greatest effect on heavy and binge drinkers. So we need to do both. Look at that beer there. You can see that the big carton, the 1 liter carton, the 750 ml, is sold at a lower unit price per alcohol than the smaller units. This encourages heavy drinking. I'm not going to talk much now about the reduction in the legal limits of drinking and driving. There's a very, very strong case to be made for that. Another crucial area is reducing the availability of alcohol, and really three ways of doing that. One is to reduce the density of liquor outlets. Second is to reduce trading hours. And the third is to stop these big containers, 1 liter bottles of beer, 5 liter bottles of wine. And we know that by reducing this availability can have a very significant reduction in alcohol consumption. Finally, and we've spoken about this, and we've heard from the department as well, we know that counseling, brief interventions, both for pregnant women can reduce fetal alcohol, and for younger people as well, putting in place therapeutic responses, counseling, is absolutely vital to begin to break the cycle. So my last two slides, what I've shown you are five best buys that the World Health Organization says are the most significant and influential ways when put together, of starting to reduce alcohol that will reduce gender-based violence. This requires an intergovernmental, interdepartmental strategy to put it all together. And I would argue that the Department of Social Development is the key department that should be convening a task team to actually reduce alcohol, because of this cycle of marginalization, heavy drinking that we need to break. Then there's some current legislation that needs to be attended to. The Control of Marketing of Alcohol Beverages Bill, I don't need to tell you, that's been around since 2013, never released for public comment. We have to understand what it says in terms of advertising. The Liquor Products Amendment Bill, again, some key elements to it. The limits on advertising, the increase in the legal drinking age from 18 to 21, which is so crucial because the brain is developing as a teenager between 18 and 21, and our children are frying their brains by drinking so much alcohol. And then prohibition on liquor outlets. And then obviously the road traffic bill as well. These need to come to the table urgently as a matter of urgency in reducing gender-based violence, in addition to some of the other ills that we have in our country. So let's make some good come out of COVID. There's been this natural experiment that's shown up the harms of alcohol. I've shown that South Africa's heavy drinking culture is rooted in the structural violence of apartheid. It requires structural intervention. What's not going to work, as we've seen, is a total ban on alcohol simply because it can't be sustained. Illegal industries will boom. Any sort of suggestion that the alcohol industry brings to the table, that we must appeal to the individual for responsible drinking, is not going to work because socioeconomic circumstances are driving life choices. Industry self-regulation doesn't work. It worries me when I hear that the SAB is a partner or a contributor to the WhatsApp line. I think we have to be very, very careful about the line that we have with the department and with the industry and their insidious invasion into the role of government. What could work is implementing these five strategies: best buy, value for money, that could reduce mortality, gender-based violence, and social fragmentation. Yes, change will take time, but we can start now. And if we do it, within the framework of a bigger commitment to addressing gender-based violence, we will achieve changes in the culture of heavy drinking, which will have a massive spin-off effect for social development. The time is now. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yo! Thank you, Dr. Harrison. Up front, there can be no debate that the pursuit of discouraging drinking alcohol is necessary. Effects are there. History is there to explain the damage. But doability can at times look easier said than done. And I think you are challenging us to, in that manner, that if we agree that these are the consequences of alcohol, this is what the alcohol is doing to humanity, and against the campaigns that we are trying to pursue, reducing GBV and the many other costs, you are tabling and challenging us that there's path. Where I'm sitting, I'm clear in my mind that you are correct. You are correct, multi-sectoral, interdepartmental, and so on. And you're correct when you say social development must show the main interest. Although social development, if you check, they deal with the consequences of alcohol. But I'm going to make sure that, because before 1:30, you must be out of this place. I'll give not more than 2 minutes, even less if I can, to each member. Two members want questions. There's no way we'll go beyond 20 past on this thing. Honorable Ngwenya and Honorable Abrams, those are the only two members. I'm very happy about that. Honorable Ngwenya.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you so much, Mr. Harrison. I could give you the biggest hug right now. I feel so vindicated.
We must thank COVID for that.
So I am very grateful for your presentation. I hope the government listens, and I hope DSD takes up the challenge, do whatever they can to help in this. My main concern is that when I'm looking at your stats, is that with males, 15-year-olds already are involved in drinking, heavy drinking, 20-year-olds. So it is true that this is killing our youth. And it is important that we make sure that even the bill that is on the parliament now of making sure that we ban the advertising, we should do that and make sure that advertising of alcohol, because it entices our youth. So we need to make sure that that happens. So thank you very much, David. My only concern right now, I know that as DSD, there's nothing that much can be done, but as Chairperson has said, it is an interministerial challenge and duty. What really concerns me is the fact that there is of alcohol in our township. Every second street in our township has taverns and shebeens. And I feel that the liquor board must also take a charge into this and stop giving out these licenses willy-nilly. Even in front of our schools, there's shebeens, there's taverns. So it is just a comment that I wanted to make. I don't really have a question, but thank you very much for your presentation. And I truly hope that it brings the change that we need to see in our country, especially in terms of GBV, because it really is upsetting to see that women are suffering mostly with the children. The only thing that I hoped that you would show in your presentation in slide 4, I was interested in knowing what the rape cases and the femicide, the percentage that you put there, that I needed to find out the ages mostly, you know, on the rape, the male, the 40% of males that have committed rape because of being intoxicated. If I can get the ages around that and the race around that, and the one on femicide of the women who were involved and that were found to have been drinking, if I can also have the race and the age around that. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you so much, David.
Honorable Abrams.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Dr. Harrison, for the presentation and to all the other collaborators. My question to you is just, I'd like to know, have you discussed this presentation with the alcohol industry, with SAB, with other alcohol industries, the wine farms, etc., and what has been the input in it or comments on it, and do you foresee a lot of resistance to your presentation? And then also, I'd like to find out, in your policy brief, you speak a lot about, you know, maybe piloting it or looking at that in the Western Cape. And I'd like to find out, have you taken this presentation to the Western Cape government, to the other spheres of government at local level as well? And then also, of the 16 countries that you are basing this evidence on, are any of them developing countries with similar socioeconomic problems, situation like South Africa, or are they all first world countries? And then also, hypothetically speaking, if we could implement this MUP tomorrow, can your research tell us how long before, will it be months, will it be years, before we see some positive impact from this presentation? And now I understand that this is just the one aspect, and that, you know, it's a multiple whole of government approach to this problem that we're in. But then I also want to find out from you, once again, a hypothetical question. If we increase the cost of alcohol and it's still not working, and then we increase it again and we increase it again until we actually get the desired results we're looking for, are we not then completely sidelining a group of South Africans who then just basically won't be able to afford to buy alcohol? And how are we going to, you know, mitigate against that? And then just lastly, just a comment. I mean, I think COVID-19 has also showed us another side of South Africans, in that this is supposed to be a deterrent from people buying alcohol, but we did see quite a few South Africans, you know, buying the higher illegal cigarettes and buying alcohol illegal at higher prices. And, you know, alcohol and drugs and substance, it's a disease on the one hand, but it's also...
Yeah.
And I just want to make that point that, you know, it's, this is not just a one-sided thing. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Evans. You are the last one I will stop. And then the minister will need to make a comment.
No, just very briefly. Thank you very much. Just very briefly, Honorable Chair. I think we need to appreciate the presentation by Dr. Harrison. It's a straightforward presentation. I don't think we must actually open it up for any vulgarization of some sort. It's a straightforward presentation with clear recommendations, well done, well-crafted research. And I think we must be able to appreciate it and say, these are some of the solutions that we need for our government moving forward. And we really appreciate that. And I don't think we must, at the risk of sounding a bit irrelevant, Honorable Chairperson, let's not play politics about some of the solutions which have been presented to our people. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Honorable Minister, do you want to make any comments?
Thank you, Chairperson, and I wish to thank the Portfolio Committee for inviting Dr. Harrison, and I thank him also for indicating the role that has to be played by the Department of Social Development here. And I fully agree that the state at which we are in terms of consumption of alcohol and what it does is untenable now. And this is the time for us to seriously do something about it. I agree with the previous members who spoke about it. And I think that the Department of Social Development has to have, not partners, but the Department of Social Development has to look for, within cabinet itself, by the way, I think that we need to look for friends of the department when it comes to fighting this, because I don't even want to have to make any arguments for. I want to make arguments for not, because as he rightfully does, he goes to the historical background. How did we get to where we are? And we are failing to go back to the history. And I don't think that we should be a nation that is actually proud of how much we are drinking, how much. And I know that there's got to be the balance, as some others say, the economy and all that. But right now in this, And Honorable Ngwenya speaking about what is happening in the townships, every street, and how many of these shebeens and all that you have. The pride of men thinking that when they are drunk and they go home and the following day, they wake up in the morning, both men and women, and they gloat about how much they were drinking. They gloat about how they don't know how they got to this point and that point. This is a disaster for the nation, and we must step up. And I'm saying, as a Department of Social Development, we really need to step up working with other partners to make sure that it is reversed in the best way that we can. We have to reverse it. Everyone who's sitting in the room, we fear when the children are now teenagers, we don't know, one day they're going to come into the house drunk to stupor, because in South Africa, it's no longer an issue of people just enjoying a glass of wine and a drink. It's binging and then the consequences of binging thereafter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Dr. Harrison, I don't think there's a debate about the significance of what you're putting on the table. I think where I'm sitting, all the colleagues are saying, it's a matter that should be responded to. Already the minister is taking the challenge to look at an executive level. Maybe they can call you to go and present there. And I think the Portfolio Committee will also have to go deeper into it. You may be called again. I think you are putting a journey, which I don't think anyone would actually say is not an important journey. Dr. Nkosazana, in the 90s, when she dealt with the issue of tobacco, we thought it's something that could not happen. At that time, I remember, tobacco was costing not less than $7 billion from the point of health cost in South Africa. It doesn't matter how people look at it, it reduced to a significant degree smoking in South Africa. Doesn't matter how you look at it. Because the fact, you know, when you are a smoker, you want to brag in the taxi, you want to brag in the train. When all those things were stopped, excitement from tobacco got reduced very significantly. So what I'm saying is that if it's got this cost to humanity, unless you want to make one or two comments for 2 minutes, Dr. Harrison, but we are going to attend to the point. The point is going to be attended to, and we're not going to say on this date at this time, but the principle is that is accepted, that let's check if we cannot embark on this change. Dr. Harrison?
Chairperson, thank you so much. And I really appreciate the response from the committee and from the minister. And just to be clear, we're happy to help in whatever way. There were 164 signatories on that agreement. Many of them are researchers or academics that have done the work. In that petition, all of them put up their hands to be of assistance. So we can draw on, and we'd certainly be willing to convene and help convene a bigger group so that we can get the capacity to make this happen fast. And back to the first honourable member's question around, can this happen fast? Well, Scotland introduced the minimum unit price in 2018. By 2020, it had showed a 5% reduction in heavy drinking. So it is possible. Yes, Western Cape government is very much involved in taking the lead, but I think it's absolutely crucial that national government starts to do the same. And no, we haven't approached the liquor industry yet, because I think it's very, very important that government and academics and researchers first have a very clear strategy before they start embarking with the sector. Pricing, you're absolutely right. You cannot keep increasing pricing, but we have the but what we can do here is have a balance where we're increasing pricing to a level where we're not increasing the risk. So just my final point, Chair, is that I would be delighted to work with the minister and work with the department and with the portfolio committee, bringing that full capacity to the table. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Harrison. One simple point, for instance, we may look at, call it a workshop, whatever, where the various experts come, the economists, tax experts, international comparative studies, and so on. Because South Africa cannot say we cannot explore the possibilities of discouraging alcohol consumption in South Africa and so on. I think that case is over. Thank you very much, Dr. Harrison. Lindy, quickly, COVID. We're not going to discuss it. We just need, because we don't have time now. Thank you, Dr. Harrison. You can be...
Thinking.
Thank you very much.
We've got 6 minutes or 7 minutes to deal with this, with COVID. ADG, or Minister, whatever.
Thank you.
It's just an update. We're not going to engage in discussing. I'll request members to write questions and send them. You know, the department must respond quickly in writing on those. We don't have time. ADG?
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm trying to quickly share this. It's not allowing me to. Oh, there we go. Thanks, Chair. We will just speak to the issues. Of course, we are now on level two. With level two, we are looking at a number of other areas that we can consider reducing some restrictions on. I'm not sure if you can see the presentation now, Chairperson.
Yes, but enlarge, please.
Okay, so really the intention.
You can't enlarge.
I can't, Chair.
When I say enlarge, I don't mean the print. I mean the size of the what to call.
No, thanks. Very quickly, we are at level two, of course, as you know, and basically what we're doing is we're encouraging the sector, and we continue to engage with them on a regular basis to ensure that because we're on level two, the risk of infection still remain and they're still prevalent. And so we are saying to them that they must not let their guard down. It's fundamental. You'd recall, Chair, during the Spanish flu, that the majority of people who died between the second and the third wave. So we are saying the first wave is gone. We are heading to the second and the third wave, and our sector must ensure that they're not letting their guard down. We're benchmarking, of course, with a number of other countries to see the best practices, and we're looking at Brazil, USA, Russia, Botswana, and one or two other countries just to get a sense on what they're doing in that area. We're improving our communication robustly so that the sector understands the impact of what's happening at level two. And, of course, the way in which this works, Chair, we get guidance from COCTA in terms of the areas that will be restricted or not restricted at various levels, and then we work that. So our directions are still to come, and they are to come after now that COCTA released their regulations on Monday. We are working on seeing how best we can manage that. I'll get to that very shortly. But just also, we're engaging the sector and other relevant stakeholders before finalizing these directions accordingly. I just wanted to make this point that we're actually the 25th largest population in the world as South Africa, but we're the fifth highest infection rate. Our country has the fifth largest infection rate, albeit we have very high recovery rates, which I think this morning was about 82%, and a very low death rates. So what we're asking ourselves around this is, how big is this thing, and what is this saying around the fact that we're the 25th largest population? We are beginning to look into some research around that and seeing what are some of the trends we can see along those lines. Second to lastly, just to indicate that in terms of our facilities, you'd note that COCTA has indicated that the movement and family visitations are now allowed, and we're looking at the movement of children. These, again, are proposals. In terms of some of our facilities, old age homes, we're seeing what we can do in terms of opening up these areas, because if you'd recall, the elderly haven't seen their families for the past 5 months or so. And the fact that we're at level two, we don't know what's going to happen when there's an increase again in the next few weeks. And we're told that in the next 10 days to 15 days, we should expect a serious increase of numbers again, because we're at level two and a lot of activity is underway again. So we're thinking that in terms of old age homes, we must look at how we can allow visitations, because if old people fall sick at old age homes, the next place they're taken are hospitals. And so at hospitals, it's even worse. You're not even able to go into the hospital. So we are concerned that the elderly are passing on without even having a chance to meet with their families. So we're trying to see how we can manage that. The CYCCs, which are children's homes and secure centers, we are still saying that we are restricting visitations with vigorous monitoring and following of protocol. So there will be visitation, but restricted. Same with the treatment centers, same with the shelters and residential shelters, and same with the shelters for homeless people. Of course, we're continuing to provide the service that we do, and COCTA and SALGA continue to provide the infrastructure in that regard. Just very quickly, on ECDs, we're saying that, of course, we all know that ECDs are open. We are just saying that in line with the court decision that was taken, ECDs remain open subject to the various measures put in place. And of course, we are continuing the support through providing PPEs and seeing how best we can assist the sector. We're engaging with the sector in this regard. We know that there are challenges around the workforce, and we know that there are challenges around some ECDs having challenges with closure. We're looking into these measures together with the sector to see how best we can assist them over and above providing PPEs. So we are also looking at other measures, including employment stimulus, etc. So those are some of the measures that we're putting in place. You know, Chair, the biggest challenge we have with ECDs is that you have just over now, I believe that what we're beginning to hear more and more is that the unregistered ECDs are just above 40,000. So at first we thought it's 33 to 35,000 or so, but it's actually between the range of 40,000 and possibly 50,000 ECDs that are not registered. So we're saying we're ramping up our Bangasali program to the next phase, which is to massify the registration of ECDs. And then we're also saying that, of course, we've provided guidelines and SOPs which serve as a guide to ECDs in terms of how they should manage screening, how they should manage play areas, and how they should engage in terms of the changing some level of, what you're teaching, the stimulus work, but there's another word that we use, curriculum. That's the word I'm looking for. So these are guidelines, not prescriptive. These are guidelines that we're providing to the sector. In terms of food, we are saying that we still have the challenge of the demand which exceeds the availability, but we're engaging with Treasury and other institutions to see how best we can crowd in a little bit more funding in this area. And we are saying that our own CNDCs are going to continue with the knock and drop service. So as opposed to providing a plate of food, we want to still provide food parcels and other measures so that we're able to deal with that. Very quickly, maybe if you ask the, okay, this is just highlighting the impact on our business continuity, basically in the DSD. We are saying that in the sector, and this doesn't include NDA and SASA, the number of offices have closed. I think we have over 137 offices that have closed, of course, bringing an impact to the continuation of service delivery. When I say closed, I mean they're closed for sanitization and decontamination. It's not closed continuously. So we close them for those 24 hours and then we reopen. So, of course, we've had a number of fatalities. These numbers have since increased dramatically. I think we're sitting on around almost 25 fatalities in the entire sector now across the provinces. And a number of our staff are still waiting results and in isolation. But we are continuing to follow the relevant protocols in this regard and ensuring that contact tracing and isolation, et cetera, are being done accordingly. So some of these are affecting service delivery, but we have put measures in place to try and see how best we can manage that. Maybe I can ask the CEO Sasa of NDA quickly to talk to this slide, which basically deals with the updates from the NDA side. And then following this, we'll have the CEO Sasa. CEO of NDA?
NDA?
Chair, with your guidance, can we take the CEO of SASA first and then come back to the NDA?
Okay, SASA. What happened to the NDA? They disappeared.
I think Baseko and the chair.
Thank you very much, DG, honorable members, chairman. I thought rather than just talk to the issue of the payments, it's important to highlight the number of hours that we've lost and the impact on our offices. We have had quite a number of fatalities in our space, particularly in terms of deaths. They've increased from the 11 deaths we had last week. We are now sitting at 13 deaths. So it is beginning to impact in our space and making sure that all the places for servicing people continue to be open. But the comforting issue is the fact that the recoveries are quite high, particularly in the Eastern Cape where the bulk of the fatalities have actually happened. We've had 102 people actually recovering, even though the confirmed cases are 139. So that is showing a good sign. The other challenging issue to manage is just the panic when people know that somebody is positive, and to make sure that we all continue to and encourage our people to keep calm and make sure that work still does happen. And for us to continue to make sure that we create opportunities for us to be able to enable people to work offline, yet in some instances, like in your supply chain environment, it becomes a challenge because it's impacted by the laws and regulations that say people should actually use paper. And we don't want to be found to be wanting when it comes to audit time. So on the issue of the payment, we've just recently gone through our next cycle of payment, and that went through okay, except for instances with regards to the persons with disabilities who fell off from the track because we were waiting for the directions to be re-signed. They've been re-signed and they will be brought back onto the cycle for them to continue to be get paid going forward. We continue to engage with labor because there's concern about us opening up for persons with disabilities for us to phase it in for them to begin to come to our offices so that they can be able to get the service. The doctors are comfortable to come back. In instances where we use the health facilities, it's becoming quite a huge challenge in terms of us being able to get that support. But I thought it was important rather than talk to the payment numbers just to indicate what the impact of COVID is in our different infrastructures and we'll provide the report in terms of where we are with payment. Thank you, Chair.
Has the NDA resurfaced?
Ah. Oh, okay. Yeah, let me... CEO of NDA? I'm sorry. Let me try and talk to them. Oh, I could have spoken to them because I'm aware of them. Very briefly, we continue with our volunteer program and we're trying to find ways to increase the numbers. As I indicated before, these are our foot soldiers on the ground and they're really, really assisting us across the country. The other day we were in, I was in a mall and there was a whole lot of people at a SASSA office. And I tried to engage with our people to see how we can extend our volunteers to also try and assist in terms of queue management there because the lines are really, really increasing at post offices. We're also talking to the post office in this regard to try and see how they can assist us. Just an update on current funds. I think we've paid just over, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's over 17 million rand last week, 17 and a half million rand. If not 100, how much is it? I think it's 17 and a half million rand that we paid in 1 week last week. And we have paid 131 CSOs. And we're continuing to make the payments in this regard so that they're able to do their work around assisting us in the GBV sector. I must highlight that we were given 12 months to do this project since January. We are on month number 8 now. And we've already paid a significant amount of CSOs. We're continuing to do this and we think that we can actually do much more. But what we're doing is because the money we have is not enough, we are also talking to other institutions, Solidarity and one or two others, to see how we can build up more money so that we are able to further support the sector in this regard. As you know, the fiscus is extremely strained. And we're talking to other institutions to work with in this regard. Just on office rationalization, we are saying the money that we would have spent for rent at a number of our offices in various provinces, we're now beginning to redirect that money to see how best we can assist the sector because we're saving that money. What we're doing in the majority of the provinces is that within DSD offices, we're trying to see where we can bring in some of our staff. Instead of paying rent for NDA offices, we're saying perhaps they can be housed in some of the DSD provincial and regional offices. So that's helping us in terms of saving money there. And in terms of business continuity, I think we continue at the NDA. We're also working a hybrid model where some colleagues are working from home and some are working from the office and they rotate regularly. Of course, there has been one or two infections and we continue to follow the relevant protocols in this regard. Now that we're at level 2, we're trying to get guidance from PPSA in terms of what do we do around staff. Of course, those with comorbidities and those over 60 continue to work from home. Thank you, Chair. Let me leave it at that.
Minister, do you want to say anything, one or two, and before we close?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's all covered. I think that there are just if members have got other issues that might be relating to COVID-19 and what maybe they come across and you know it's we open for that kind of engagement because unfortunately I think the manner in which we're presenting now we had very little time so we're not able to go further and the members are not even able to engage with what we have presented here so my request is that if in case there are other things that members want are critical of what is being presented here they can just send us through your office Chairperson, in case they want
Okay. Other
issues to clarify.
I think the request I'm going to ask, we've got no permission to go up to 3 o'clock. You have to get that permission. And I want to say to the members, can they write their questions? Can we make sure that it is by the sun sets tomorrow, the responses will have been circulated?
Yeah, I think that's fine, Chairperson, because it would also, even when we come to the next meeting, if in case we feel there are things that we need to report, because this is a standing item now. Every time we have the meeting, we'll have to, if there are issues that we didn't cover now because of time, we can respond to that. If they were not adequately answered, we can deal with them in the next meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. But the one point I want to hammer on, DG, is that we don't have to remind the department that this is a standing item. That's why that 48-hour is so critical. Just you circulate the document, because we reduce the time of your presentation. We take time more on engagement, and it makes us use the time in a more fruitful way than the other way. Lindy? Not my game.
I was about to say, yo. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Ntsavo. anything else?
No, Chair. We've concluded the agenda for the day. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for that cooperation as usual. I'll always love you, and we'll work together in this session. And at that point in time, the meeting is closed. Thank you very much. Have a good day in Parliament.
Viva Madiba, viva.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.